We've been talking in our council meetings about the fact that we should bring what Shambhala is more into our talks and our discussions. And so I was trying to think about how to do that. And so I looked up, I actually Googled the word Shambhala to see what I could find out. And one of the definitions that came up for Shambhala was the source of happiness, which I thought was very nice. And I thought about, well, where does this all come from? And Shambhala was, the inspiration for Shambhala was a kingdom at around the time of the life of the Buddha, where there was a king by the name of Dawasangpo. And he said to the Buddha that he would like to practice the Dharma. He would like to participate in, the Buddhist, at that time, the Buddhist teachings. But he couldn't leave his kingdom. At that time, the Buddha, had left home, and he and his disciples, I guess, were wandering around, and they were being hosted by various different kings who gave them land and food and et cetera. And when they came to Dawasangpo, Dawasangpo said, well, I would like to be your student, but I can't leave my kingdom. I feel responsible, and I enjoy what I'm doing, and people depend on me. And isn't there some way that I can combine the practice of meditation and my kingdom, my life as a monarch, and especially my life as a person who is not only a ruler, but someone who really cares very deeply for the culture of my kingdom. And so the Buddha gave him some teachings, and what Dawasangpo was able to do was to encourage the people of his kingdom to meditate, to practice, and at the same time to encourage learning and culture and family life and all of the things that people needed to do in order to have their world. So really what he did was to bring together what we might call the sacred path with the secular. To bring together the sacred practice and study and bring it into the secular world. And his particular kingdom was known for being very inclusive. People were honored and respected regardless of their level of education or what they did, who they were, what they practiced. And it became an example of a society that was based on the principles of inherent good heart, which in Shambhala we generally call that basic goodness. That everyone had developed their inherent good heart. And the society of people who live that way, in Shambhala we would call an enlightened society. A society of people who were not only kind and benevolent, but also who developed their own insight, their own path of practice. So we in Shambhala, we use that as our example. This is what we aspire to. This is what we consider to be the source of happiness. Not stuff, things, but some kind of society, some kind of life that is imbued with our inherent good heart, which longs to connect. We all long to connect in some way. Some of us want to connect with others. Some of us want to connect with art. Some people want to connect with nature. Some people just want to connect with simplicity. So whatever it is, we long to connect. So how do we combine that with a sense of sacredness? What does that mean? Sacredness and secular. Well, generally, I think when we think of sacred, we think of something that's worthy of to be revered, that's very special, that has a particular kind of feeling. It's kind of like when you walk in this room, right? From the outside, you take your shoes off, you walk in this room, the shrine is there, there's a certain kind of setup, and there's an atmosphere here that it changes your posture, it changes your demeanor, it changes your attitude before you even do anything, before you even sit down. And we feel a sense of respect and appreciation, maybe. And we feel, you know, sort of drawn out in a different way. So, I mean, we can even talk later about what your idea of sacredness is. And it's interesting, I was studying with this one teacher, and he was talking about this idea of sacred world and bringing that into your world. And he said, you know, one of the reasons for a shrine room or meditation room and the way that we relate to it, he says, is not just to create this special place that's different, but to have a way of recognizing sacredness and how it affects us, and then to somehow bring that, to feel some kind of expression of bringing that into our everyday life. You know, like when you walk into your house, or you walk into your office, or you walk into the supermarket, you don't feel the same way as you do when you walk in this room. But what if you actually carried some of that respect and a sense of upliftedness into whatever environment you go into? What if, just like the practice of meditation is to help us develop a sense of peace, get connected with who we are, appreciation for ourselves, finding some kind of quiet, finding some sort of friendliness. So what if we could combine that with a sense of that the whole world, it actually has, could be seen or could be related to with more of this kind of sacred attitude? This interesting question, something to think about. So another way of talking about bringing sacredness and the secular world together, we often talk about it as joining heaven and earth. So heaven, you could say, is like the sacred, it's the high, it's the divine. And the earth is where we live. So bringing those two things together, and a lot of the kind of art that we do, flower arranging and calligraphy, any kind of contemplative art like that is based on that notion of joining heaven and earth. In our sitting practice, how we talk about it is synchronizing body and mind. When we sit down and take our posture, if you think about it, or if you just allow yourself to feel it, it's very similar to walking into this room. You take a good posture, and immediately you feel a sense of dignity, a feeling of openness and upliftedness, and almost a feeling of kind of sacredness. Feeling of sacredness, maybe not even almost. And then when we begin to work with our breathing, then we're bringing that into the earth. Then we're bringing that into our world, into our, you know, our secular life. That's what we do as humans. We breathe and we live. So when we practice, we're joining those two things together. This sense of upliftedness in our posture, and then the natural humanness that we have, that we connect with through our breathing. And, you know, we do this in a lot of different avenues. When you learn to play an instrument, or you learn some kind of art, it's a very similar kind of thing. You start with a feeling of like you're not really sure, but then you begin by putting your materials together, learning how to do one hand and then the other hand, and then eventually you put it all together. And just like in meditation, you put it all together, and at a certain point you don't even really have to think so much about it. You think about great instrumentalists or poets or equestrians. They're not really thinking all that much about their the steps. They completely let go, and they're just in the moment. And that's a feeling of synchronization. So our path, so to speak, is to begin to explore our inherent good heart, both in our practice of meditation and in our lives. And in Shambhala, that's considered to be a somewhat brave thing to do, because in most of our culture, that's not necessarily encouraged. I have a number of friends who have... I have one friend in particular. We work together. And she told me the story once. She said that she and her husband had been going to this church for a while, and they went on this Sunday morning, and the minister was talking about kindness and, you know, I mean, basic Christian doctrine of being kind to others, etc. And she said then she went out in the parking lot, and they were about to leave, and somebody just drove right in front of them and cut them off. This was like in the parking lot of the church. And she said, I just don't get it, you know. People walk out of the church and it's gone. It was completely gone. So our sort of view is that we don't want to leave it in the shrine room, so to speak. When we get up after our practice, we would like to carry over into our lives. And it's a life's work. And it's more than just meditation. It's contemplating various slogans, etc. So a person who does this, according to the Shambhala teachings, a person who is willing to do this is called a warrior. Not because they make war, but because of the bravery and the training. And you think, what does a warrior have? They have training, they have loyalty, they have discipline, and they have a commitment to their ruler, they have a commitment to their kingdom, and they have a commitment to themselves. So I had been thinking about the book, The Sacred Shambhala, The Sacred Path of the Warrior, and these are some of the thoughts that came to me. So it's just kind of a general talk, but and so I'm interested to hear, I'd like to hear from you how you view this idea of sacred, bringing sacredness and the secular world together. What does that mean to you? How do you think that you work with that? What are the challenges?
I'm thinking of an example. Leela and I were talking, and she knew instantly when I didn't get what she was saying.
Mm.
There was a communication going on. And I kind of think somehow that particular kind of joining, being able to actually into where someone's at and to be present with them,
mm-hmm.
is part of being of sacredness, is just being present. Because when she let me know, I knew instantly she was right and that I had left our conversation in some way, and it brought me right back to being present in our conversation. So I don't know how that really relates, but it does in some way to me.
Mm-hmm.
For me, what sacredness is when I can actually be where I'm at and appropriately kind of where I'm at, doing what is natural, like listening was, should have been.
And doing, and it also sounds like you were doing that, you were experiencing that in a very non-biased way. Mm-hmm. I mean, you weren't resentful.
No.
You were actually appreciative.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm new to Shambhala, but I'm not new to meditation and other spiritual disciplines. Something I noticed recently, I was in a very largely stressful situation where there were several people who were severely against me for totally illusionary reasons, and I knew they were illusionary, but they thought they were real. So I found myself just at times, and you know, I was well aware of this, you know, they're viciously, viciously against me. Just for figments of their imagination. And this is sort of a group imagination, just sort of a negative mythology built up about me. So these people, sometimes I would try to talk to them, but they didn't want to listen to me. But what I found myself doing occasionally, not even thinking about it, is just looking into their eyes,
mm-hmm.
and letting them know, you know, this is me, why are you persecuting me?
That's a very brave thing to do.
It wasn't really something I thought about. It's something I found myself doing. It came from my subconscious or my superconscious, probably my superconscious. Mm-hmm. It's just when those things happen, what we do as a conscious ego is we just let it happen and not try to stop it.
Yeah, it sounds like it's in both of the examples, it sounds like something about being in the present moment, you know, and accepting what's going on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's such a hard thing to do sometimes. I was at the place called The Hub, which is where people come to get benefits and stuff like that in Boulder County. And there was a guy that was... which is kind of typical in a sense. He's talking to himself and walking really fast, like around the room. It's a big room, but he was just walking, he had his coat on. Then he'd get to a certain part of the room and start talking to himself, and then he'd keep going. And typically my reaction is one of sort of, watching what's going on, being defensive about, I don't want him in my space. You know, what are you doing? I don't, you know, is he going to blow? I don't know. But this time it was interesting because I realized as I watched him walk briskly by me like 10, 20 different times, I got it that what he was trying to do was soothe himself. And that's how he was doing it.
Mm.
And that's what I do. I try to soothe myself. And some of my stuff is I can do it without anyone knowing it. Or I can do it sort of in a socially acceptable way, but here's this guy who's kind of, you know, madly kind of running around the room. But just that moment of going, oh, he's doing what I do, it's like there. I wasn't thinking about myself in that moment of I've got to protect myself. I was thinking, oh, having some sort of connection with this person that was doing something that was at first a little alarming, and then it was like, oh, I know what he's doing. I know what he's doing. And good. You know, good. Keep walking, you know, whatever it takes that you have to do to soothe yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there was something about switching from to, you know, just noticing mm-hmm. what he was doing, who he was, you know. This is funny, you know, because I hope I do that more than just every once in a while, but if it was neat, you know, to just, it wasn't a conscious thing, it was just, it happened. I wasn't saying, gee, I really should try to connect with this person or something like that. It was more like something just fell away, and I felt like it's okay, it's all right.
Well, I think that relates very much to what I was saying about synchronizing body and mind does bring you right into the present.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we do that when we're, especially when we're practicing, we're doing that in a special kind of situation. But then that becomes the sort of ground for when we go out into our lives, and then that experience of being able to bring yourself right to the moment is available. So bringing those two things together.
I think it's important that we keep it having more embarrassment, dropping the whole thing. We often don't. I mean, that is something that we have that we can offer to people. And maybe that's part of the secular view of sacred world, is that we can kind of be awake and sensitive and aware, not all the time, but sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And those moments are special or sacred when that happens. Or when you look at a flower sometimes and you really connect with the beauty of that. That's also a sacred experience of some kind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know what you were describing, Barbara, and what Lila was saying too, there is that moment of connection. Is at that moment, I feel like you're just creating without really doing anything, a moment of enlightened society. You know? Because they're not forcing anything, but just having that connection and fostering that. As the Sakyam says in the Shambhala Principle book, he and his father, just the two of us are a society.
Just you and me.
Just you and me. And it doesn't even necessarily have to be things that people say to each other or, you know, create an environment. But just in those little moments, it's sort of like when you, if you're walking up to a building, and there still are buildings like this, like here, where you have to actually open the door. And, you know, you glance behind you and there's somebody walking with a cane or has a baby carriage or something like that. You don't even think, I should open the door. You just do it, right? There is that moment of recognition. And to me, that sort of comes from recognizing, having respect for the environment, respect for your world, and a kind of lack of focus on yourself. So,
I think trying to always maintain the view of impermanence makes a lot of mundane things really sacred. And they can be extremely mundane, but like less mundane. What it made me think of is growing up, every Sunday we would go to my grandma's house and have dinner. And she lived in that house for like 65 years, a long time. And, you know, as a teenager and stuff, like, you know, I would skip it a lot of times. And I enjoyed it. I mean, I always liked being with her and I liked it, but like, I certainly didn't consider it sacred. And then she died and they sold everything. And I remember like during the auction, like the feeling of like that going away and thinking, like now that's gone. And, you know, what seems mundane, once it's gone, all of a sudden is sacred. And so maintaining that view of impermanence and knowing that this is sacred because it's not going to last, like this room, us like in here right now, you know, and not too far in the future, this building won't be here or this room won't be what it is, you know, and those are kind of big things. But even like sitting there watching TV with your partner or hanging out with a friend or walking your dog, you know, that's sacred. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. And it's too bad that our, you know, we have to try to maintain that view of impermanence, because if not, we just get caught up in thinking, okay, I got to go walk the dog, or okay, you know, I got to go do this again. And then once it's gone, it's this thing that you want back. And I know for me that's one way to make things more sacred, like in my everyday life, is to realize that, you know, well, you know, enjoy it while it lasts, you know, even if it's not that enjoyable at the moment, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So having having an appreciation for things. Yeah.
I was thinking a couple of things I heard tonight made me think of the presence of people and being able to connect and helps me is you go to a place like this and there's just beauty in the representation of our clear mind, and we just connect with that and sit and we get to know ourselves. And I can be close to synchronized, but I also have things pop up, resistance, embarrassment, just the so-called negative things that rise, blocking me from being just purely present. But at the bottom of all that, that's basic goodness. I know that the situation is basically good. It's really good. It's by watching the ups and downs and the non-synchronization along with the synchronization, I really finally get a connection with goodness. And by getting to know myself, I really get to know everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I go out and deal with people, just like the examples I heard, I know that there's a wisdom of knowing what's going on. And it helps connect. It helps see the goodness in all other situations, whether they're really good or not. And I think that's the kind of the journey of enlightened society, is actually knowing deeply our own good situation and not giving up on others, and trying to connect and wanting to connect. That longing just increases, and it helps to be able to connect, because you know you're connecting with reality more. And to me, that's sacredness, is just really being there with the way things are, and whether it's something I really like or don't like.
Yeah, and what you're sort of pointing to also there is that experience of beginning to make what we call make friends with yourself, or appreciate yourself, recognize that you have these ups and downs, or you have moments when your discipline is not that good, or things, you know, take you away, and then you can come back, and that it's not a problem. It's not a... I remember once going to the Vijayadhara, and I was complaining about something, you know, I can't do this. And he said, you think it's a problem, therefore it's a problem. He said, but it's not a problem. It sort of became a mantra for me for a long time. You think it's a problem, so it's a problem, but it isn't.
If he was from New York, he'd say, forget about it.
Yeah. Keep on trucking was a big one. Keep on trucking.
Well, it seems like what both of you are saying is so much more eloquent than how I could say it, but I guess I was thinking of 1,000 forgivenesses. Because I can be such an ass, you know, and I know it. And in public, with somebody I don't even know, it's like, whoa, you know. So I don't think I could get to the place of really being in that present moment if there wasn't some space that I had inside of myself to say, it's all right. You know, you're just scared, or, you know, whatever the thing is. It's not a conscious thing, but I think it is a practice, you know. Mm-hmm. There's some practice to just be kind to myself, you know. Say, it's all right, so you were a jerk. I have found myself sometimes apologizing to people in public, which is really interesting. People are flipped out when you do that, because they're not used to it. They're just not used to that, mm-hmm. you know. And there's a few times I think, well, I should say something to her, and it's like, nah, you know. But sometimes I found myself doing that, and it's pretty expansive thing. And I have to remind myself that I could do it, you know. If I could break through the, you know, ego or whatever, I could do that. There's always, the clean slate the next day kind of thing, or just something. It's always, you can always kind of redo it. Mm-hmm. And you know, and just be nice to yourself when you don't, you know.
Yeah, what you're saying, that I was thinking that if you do that, if you acknowledge on the spot, then you have no hangover.
Yeah, right.
Right. There's no hangover the next day of like shoulda, woulda, you know, and then you feel guilty and all that. It's
you're just on
the spot. And like you say, it is very interesting for people to have somebody say, oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
I did that one time in a public thing, and the next day I was teaching a little bit of Tai Chi So I, you know, apologized to these people I was a jerk to about where they were sitting, or I forget what the thing was. And I thought the next morning, I thought, boy, I wonder if anybody's going to come to this Tai Chi thing. And they came. They just showed up, you know, I was like, okay, you know.
Mm.
So, yeah, you never know where it's going to go.
I'm thinking about warriorship when we're talking here a lot, because it sounds so different, but I actually feel sometimes, I feel that sense of being a warrior when I can actually be present and be not have an agenda, and somehow the better parts of me emerge. And that comes from the training, but it's just the notion of that has something sacred, some quality of sacredness to me when I think of myself as a warrior.
I think that's very, very important. I mean, we spend a lot of time kind of cowering behind our little shields of stuff. You know, when warriorship is like driving it and being open to what actually is right now. And that takes a lot of courage. And like warriorship, I mean, a warrior is not, it's not that they don't feel fear. They feel plenty of fear. But they face it and transcend it or something. I don't know what the word is.
Mm.
Yeah, get past it.
Mm. Yeah. Well, for me, having to at times experience where I'm just about to become fearful. What helps me is to take my seat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a posture, it's a kind of opening. It's not allowing myself to be swept away by, you know, like today I was driving in the wind, which is one of my bugaboos. I hate driving in the wind. And, you know, I could just feel the car starting to move, and it's like, wait a minute. I don't have to give my power to the wind, you know. I can take my seat and hold on to the wheel and just, you know, little movements, you know, to keep it on track. And, another way of looking at that kind of facing fear and just like not letting it, it's still kind of tenuous, but at the same time, I, you know, having a way of just stopping the mind, stopping the movement, and just like you do when you sit down on your cushion and you take your seat, and then you're just there.
One thing no one has mentioned tonight is sense of humor.
Uh-huh.
Like when that thing comes along, it always, you always react to, like, here it comes again. Here I'm going to go walk into my thing now. You know, and you sort of like, the absurdity of it kind of catches you. And then at that moment, you can actually, you know, be there and do something different. Sometimes.
Sometimes. It's funny either way, right?
Yeah.
I have to be really careful with that because I don't want to really laugh at myself. I have to actually appreciate what you're saying is appreciate.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's not quite appreciation. It's more of a, you know, cynical laugh.
Yeah. But you know that. You know that, mm-hmm. that difference. Even if there's a skinny, tiny little line between it, mm-hmm. you know where you are on that. Which side of that line you're on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
One thing we haven't talked about is path.
Mm-hmm.
It's a path. It's a very funny path. Unusual or something, in the sense that a lot of times you don't feel like you're on a path. You're just doing it. You know, and in the book, a lot of other places, Trump always said to stop and look back. It's important to look back because then you realize you actually you aren't there anymore. You're somewhere else. That's that's important, because if it's just day to day and never looking back, it doesn't feel like you've done much.
Mm-hmm.
that's what Kiki So-So is.
Yeah.
Is, you know, being on top.
Of yeah, yeah, looking back.
Where
yeah.
You came from.
Yeah.
Say more about that.
Well, like the Tibetans and the Palis and stuff, and they get to Kiki So-So is they'll do that on top of the mountain pass. And you always stop and turn around and look at how far you've come.
Well, I took this course a long time ago in the Shambhala Center, and we were talking about the Four Noble Truths. So there's suffering, and the origin of suffering, and the goal, and the path. And so we were saying, well, which is more important, the goal or the path? And we decided that the path was the most important, to continually move forward. Like you're saying, looking back, but it's